Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Elaine West, the founder of Rooterville Animal Sanctuary. Launched by West more than two decades ago and located in Melrose, Florida, Rooterville is a refuge housing rescued farm animals, including plenty of pigs, as suggested by the sanctuary's wonderfully wry name. Other animals living there include cows, goats, turkeys, many horses, and many others. I spoke with West about 7 years ago, and this seemed like a good moment for an update on Rooterville, in no small measure because the sanctuary has undergone some significant changes. Those include relocating after a foundation whose funding had helped sustain the organization since 2011 into the support of Rooterville and other sanctuaries in 2021. West rebounded in part by reinventing Rooterville, expanding the sanctuary's longstanding educational objectives and opportunities to spend time with the animals by enthusiastically embracing agritourism. Now, for example, you can stay in a covered wagon or the farmhouse, pitch a tent and camp there, park your RV on site, amongst other scenarios. Heck, you can even hold your wedding at Rooterville. These and other elements, including a Highland cow named Jet, who's developed into an enormously charismatic, popular presence, have helped right the Rooterville ship. We'll discuss this and more when I speak with Elaine West in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. I want to be sure to acknowledge that today and tomorrow, potentially, the FWC meets for its final vote on the bear hunt. I wish I were more optimistic about the outcome, but we'll continue, of course, to track this story as we have since the first announcement of the potential bear hunt service. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's show, I'll speak with Emily Capus, Chief Curator at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in the St. Petersburg Repository of various types of art, often including fauna-oriented work, such as rare air, endangered birds, bats, butterflies, and bees. The current exhibition I'll discuss with Emily when I speak with her later in today's show. Right now, though, let's talk Rooterville, rescued farm animals, and something of a case study of a sanctuary reinventing itself with Rooterville founder Elaine West. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Elaine West back after some years to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Elaine.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. Thanks so much for having me again. Wow, that was quite the introduction that I got there. Amazing.
Yeah, well, there's a lot, I think, a lot of important stuff to cover, and I think some really kind of illuminating things for people who care about or maybe even are involved with sanctuaries themselves. So, but let's start with some Rooterville history and maybe Elaine West history, and then we'll move into the more recent years and the accompanying changes that I referred to. So, you appear to have had a lifelong passion for pigs. Can you talk about why? Why do you love pigs so much? What is it about them?
Well, you know, when I was young, I grew up around farms. All of my mom's family, they were all farmers. And my brothers would bale hay in the summer for my one farmer relative. And they would always bring home the runt baby pigs that were just thrown onto a pile to die. So I, you know, got to nurse a few little pigs back to life, and I just loved them. I mean, they're so smart and they're so clean. And when I found out my local Humane Society was giving them away with no opportunity to get a real home, they were being eaten, I was pretty appalled. And so I learned that there are lots and lots of pigs that end up needing rescue, many more than the system or the people that are helping them can handle, actually. It's really a sad situation. But so many of these animals need help, and there are so few people actually helping them. So I got involved, and that was many, many years ago, over 30 years ago. You know, I started spaying and neutering them and finding them homes, and eventually there really are no homes left for, you know, pigs that need help. So I turned to sanctuaries, and I never wanted to have a sanctuary, but here I am.
Yeah.
Over 20 years.
Well,
you know, I've operated Rooterville, and at one point, we were up to 300 rescued pigs, all spayed and neutered, and all receiving amazing care, you know, thanks to the foundation that was our support.
Yeah, but, well, you've touched on a bunch of things that we'll delve into more deeply for sure.
Okay.
But as I recall from when we spoke some years ago, wasn't there was, maybe it was your first pig, but there was some pig where I felt like kind of had a pivotal effect, and it sounded like you often saw them at home. Where did you grow up again? Remind me. I can't remember where. If you
up in Illinois, up by the Chicago area, the suburbs of Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So what was that? Was there a first pig, or at least someone, an early pig that really seemed to mesmerize you in some way and maybe helped launch you in the direction of the work that you did for all these years since?
Well, the first pig that I rescued that started it all was just a little pig, and I can't even remember her name. It's been so long ago.
Wow.
But I rescued her from the Humane Society that I mentioned that was giving them away to be eaten. It just happened that I went there to adopt a dog, and I asked before I had two pet pigs of my own, and I asked before I do all this paperwork, can I just take it home and make sure it's going to get along with my pet pigs? And they said, oh, we have a pet pig. You know, we have a pig in the back. And I went back there, and there was a beautiful little pig that rolled over for a belly rub as soon as I started to talk to her. And I went back in, and I said, what are you doing with that pig? And they said, well, we've given it to the guys that are trimming our trees. Well, they were going to take it and barbecue it. So I shamed them out of the pig, and that was the first, that was the one that started it all. But the one that really turned the corner and caused me to do Rooterville Sanctuary and kind of my my interpretation of a sanctuary, which is a lot different than most people's.
How so?
Well, because most sanctuaries don't allow visitors from the public to come. So we've always had open gates where visitors could come and experience the animals, because to me, warehousing animals is not a very, first of all, it's not a viable business model. There just aren't enough donations for pig sanctuaries. It's just the way it is.
Right.
And
meanwhile, there's so many expenses, I guess, with food and veterinary care and other upkeep and stuff.
Oh, veterinary care is crazy.
Yeah.
After COVID, the veterinary care has just gotten nuts. You know, by being open to the public, I'm sharing these animals, and so I'm encouraging people to look into how animals are raised for food and, you know, and see that they're no different than a dog or a cat, and they have personalities, and just to try to help people put a face with their food and hopefully leave here and make kinder choices. That's the end game for me.
Right. So let's talk about then sort of what would be the kind of the early years of Rooterville. Once you said, well, I'm helping rescue pigs and I'm going to make this more official with a sanctuary, can you just sort of talk about the early phases of that and just kind of how it evolved over time?
Yeah, well, I met my my late husband in 2005, and at that time I had about 50 pigs in my little start of a sanctuary, and you know, he married into it, but he loved them, he loved the animals, and he passed away in 2015 suddenly with no warning. And at that time we had, you know, 300 pigs, and it was a big operation at that point. And then I forgot where I was going with that, Duncan.
Well, basically, I think we were talking about sort of the early years of launching Rooterville and sort of how it developed and evolved.
So when I was doing it myself, then I would meet people, you know, being out and about and going to events and tabling and things like that. Other people that wanted to help and wanted to get involved. So I started getting volunteers, and then volunteers from U.S. Started coming. They have great student organizations, and they come and volunteer regularly. And so people wanted to come, and people enjoyed it. They enjoyed coming and interacting with the animals. And so that made me want to, you know, go public with the sanctuary, let people come in. It used to be by donation, and now we require, you know, an entrance fee when they come. But people just enjoyed it so much, and it was a shame to, you know, to not let people come and have that experience.
And what do you think at the beginning, and maybe it's changed over time, but what do you think people get out of those kind of visits, that kind of close proximity to pigs and the other farm animals that are rescued and living at Rooterville?
Well, I can tell you that they love it. They leave with so much joy. It just brings so much joy, and the cow cuddles especially. And people just love it. And I think they leave with a new, because I always hear, you know, I didn't know pigs were so smart, or I didn't know pigs were so clean. And the cows, you know, they make a connection with the cows. So they just learn the personalities that these animals, they love to be brushed, they love to be scratched, they love treats, they love to interact with people. They're not mean, they're not crazy. So it just lets people see them in a different light. And then we have educational signs around the property that kind of introduce people to the way modern agriculture, the way they raise animals and treat animals, and the environmental implications that they create, with the water and the pollution and the wiping out our forest to plant crops to feed animals. So we just try to open that door for some awareness of the facts, and then hope people will take those facts and start looking a little deeper and maybe making some changes in their own lives.
Yeah, especially if they've fallen in love with a pig or a cow that day.
Yeah,
that they visited.
When you know.
Yeah.
When you have a face, and especially the little kids, they think a pig and what they're eating. They're quick to make the connection. With our habits, it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, well, but it's great that there's that educational component combined with visiting, because then I think that connection mm-hmm. can be made more. Immediately.
Absolutely.
And more profoundly, and also yep. the thinking that probably starts even before they leave the Rooterville that day can be put into place and put into action immediately,
right.
Probably.
Yeah, and we always, it's people are on their own when they're here. They get to walk around, and they can read the signs or not read the signs. Nobody's trying to push anything down anybody's throat, because that's the worst thing you can do is try to push something on somebody. So people are free to do what they want. There's no judgment here. It's just a happy place, peaceful, beautiful. Magical is used a lot to describe what we have here. It's really something special. And if you haven't experienced it, you need to come and see what we've created here.
Yeah, really would special. You say, based on, I'm sure over the years you've probably seen or been to other farm animal sanctuaries,
yeah.
Would you say there's some notable differences between Rooterville and those ones you have visited?
Yeah, absolutely, because here the environment is so relaxed and so welcoming and friendly, and, we don't have tons of rules for people, and I can tell you that 99.9% of the people come and they're wonderful. Very rarely do we ever have to correct anyone with their behavior around the animals, which is really great. So we trust people to come and be good, treat our animals like they're, we have a sign right up front. This is our home, and, you're a guest in their home. So that's the way we want them to be treated. And so we treat the animals like our friends. We don't, lord anything over them. We don't, force them to do what they don't want to do. So compared to the other sanctuaries that I've been to, first of all, us being open the way that we are and so welcoming and inviting and not being rigid and having, guided tours with animals behind fences that you can't interact with, people are on their own here when they come, and they really love that.
Well, along those lines, we talk about rescued farm animals. So I'm wondering if you could tell a few short stories about how certain animals arrived there. I'd be curious about two different main kinds of stories, in fact. One set would be stories where maybe one or two or just a small number of animals ended up there through one circumstance or another. And then I'm sure there's been some times over the years where there's been a big number of pigs or other animals either through a hoarding situation or seized by the authorities for one reason or another where they've needed a home, and Rooterville ended up being that home. Can you just give us a little sense of how some of those animals arrived there in both categories?
Yeah, well, we have... The farmed pigs, which are one, some of my favorites, the big guys. We have one, his name is Benny, and he was a piglet and fell off of a transport truck on I-75, probably headed down to South Florida. And he ended up at the rest stop in Lake City, and at 10 o'clock at night, between 10 and 11 o'clock at night, my phone was ring, ring, ringing with people calling me to come and pick him up because he was coming. He was limping, but fortunately he wasn't badly injured, which is amazing, you know, falling off of a truck on an interstate going 70 miles an hour.
For sure.
So he was lucky in that regard, but he was, you know, at that time I was widowed, and I couldn't leave and go to Lake City and pick him up. So some dog rescue people, thank God, went and got him and got him to safety. And then they kept him for a couple of years, and then he was just too big for them to handle. And so they brought him here, and he's been here now for 3 or 4 years and doing well. Still has a limp from his accident, but he's... you know, he's a big, beautiful guy, super gentle with people. And so he's here. You know, I've got pigs from hoarding situations. Most of my pigs that were from the hoarding situations I was involved in are actually gone now, because that was when I first started.
But that's not as likely to happen where people approach you with, like, hey, we've got a huge number of pigs from a hoarding situation.
Yeah,
you're just not in a position to take them probably at this point.
I am not in a position now, you know, being widowed and disabled, and I'm not in a position to take animals. So as my animals age out of my system, I'm not replacing them. For the most part. But, you know, there are some hoarding situations going on right now. And let me tell you what happens. It never fails. Somebody gets two pigs and they think, oh, it's going to be fun to have some baby pigs. And pigs are like bunny rabbits, and they breed really young and they make lots of babies. And so two pigs can turn into 200 pigs within a year.
Wow.
And then these people, of course, they can't afford to spay and neuter them. So they end up with piglets, breeding with piglets and all these pigs. And right now there are a couple situations. If people look online, they really need help. They've got, I think, 60 pigs in down by Mims, Florida. And I think I saw another rescue. It's so sad to see them, because it's like, oh, where are they going to go? But there are a lot of animals, pigs especially, that need help now.
Yeah.
You know, most people just see them as food. I would get that a lot when I first started. Like, why do you rescue pigs? We eat them. You know, people just don't get it.
Conversely, it seems like you've seen this situation a number of times that we've heard about and read about, where someone ends up with a pig, and when they get it, it's a tiny little piglet.
Yeah.
And they have no idea what they're getting themselves into. And then it becomes this huge pig. And then if like you used to say, with a second one or more, then it's like pigs everywhere suddenly before you look up. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody that is breeding pigs needs to have their head adjusted, because that's just the wrong thing to do. And more than one reason. But, you know, there are more pigs out there needing help than there are people that will help them, which is really sad. We really need sanctuaries. And it was really a tragedy when that foundation decided not to support sanctuaries anymore, because if there's one thing we need, it's places for rescued farm animals especially to go. I mean, you know, dog and cat, they have a whole lot more options than farm animals have.
Well, let's get into that in a sec, but let me first just, for people who may have tuned in a bit late and want to know who they're listening to, let me just quickly identify you. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Elaine West, founder of Rudderville Animal Sanctuary, facility in Melrose, Florida, providing refuge to rescued farm animals, you know, very much including pigs, as we've noted here. If you'd like to ask Elaine a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit more, because it sounds like that foundation was not only supporting Rudderville for a number of years, but it sounds like a number of other sanctuaries.
Yeah.
So maybe you could just talk as... Sounds like probably a bit of a sore subject, but maybe you could just talk about what changed their mind or what ended their support.
Well, I can only speculate, but I mean, I was told directly, you know, verbatim, that sanctuaries are run by mostly older, burned out women in bad locations.
And sorry to laugh at that, but that just seems so crazy and harsh.
I was told. Yeah. And let's see, there was one other thing that he told me. Oh, they're not a good, they don't offer a good return on investment. And it's like, you're rescuing animals that are helpless. Of course there's not going to be a good return on investment. I mean, come on. You're taking care of animals that need a place. They don't get jobs, you know. They can't support themselves. People have to care for them, and that takes money. It takes resources.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when you said that we, you know, redesigned Rudderville, I jumped into this agritourism. It's like, this is it right here, you know. And it would be great if e-commerce could help support it, too, because my dream was always to be able to help support other sanctuaries, because I know I can't do this forever. I'm falling apart, and I'm old. So I've got to find other ways to help other people, you know, learn how to be more self-sustainable, to not depend so much on donations. And, like, probably the first 12 or 15 years, I was totally self-funded. All of my income went to, you know, care for the animals that I had and you know, that I rescued.
Yeah.
It's a way to make money and give people an experience that could change their lives.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to some of those specifics as part of that reinvention. But I'm curious, in the early years, what it was like for you to sort of traveling what sounds like a significant learning curve. I mean, like, sort of, I guess you were sort of teaching yourself how to run a sanctuary, how to care for sort of farm animals, many of whom have been neglected or abused. So did you just teach yourself and kind of make it up as you go?
No, I was fortunate. There, you know, back in the day when I started, we didn't have streaming video. We didn't have Facebook, but we did have the internet and email. And so I had a good solid group of people who were involved in pig rescue, who love pigs. And we networked and we really worked hard together to help raise funds and come up with solutions for, you know, the big rescue situations primarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, we worked together and there were a couple of people that were wonderful with treating things, you know, identifying sicknesses or health issues and how to treat them. So I did a lot of that myself. Now the vets won't give us, you know, bottles of antibiotics and bottles of stuff for joints and pain and all that stuff. So it's really difficult now. Than when I started 30 years ago, just for that. Just to get medications now, the vet, you know, maybe unless you have a very good friend who's a vet, but mine have all retired. The ones that I was friends with are all gone now.
Mm.
But, you know, just to be able to get the medications and things that you need to be able to take care of the animals yourself without having to depend on a vet coming every time. It's $500 to get the vet out for a call.
Yeah, that adds up quick. Yeah, you gotta get a few of those. Yeah. But it sounds like you were fortunate, not so much on the vet side, although maybe that way too at one point, but just that there were people that had some expertise that stepped in and helped you and kind of guided you.
Yeah.
And
we worked together.
Yeah. Well, that's really good.
We worked together and for the benefit of the animals. And I did have a really great vet who was at UF, and he was awesome, and he took good care of me too, and he got a van. They use it now for an ambulance, but he started making farm calls, and he was so good with me when probably for 5 or 6 years, and then when he left and they got a new Dina, now they're really pricey, and it's just not the way things aren't the way they used to be. It's harder now.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very different kind of set of circumstances to try to do the same kind of work. And, and let me ask you that. To what extent do you view your work at Rudderville, even though now there's a different set of challenges, but do you look at it to what extent as a calling?
Well, you know, I laughed when I first started because I never wanted to do what I do now. But, you know, when you find out, like when I learned about factory farming, I was like, that was a calling for me. Like, I have to tell people about this because I know if people know, they won't want to support that like I was. But, you know, I thought by the time I was 60 years old now that factory farmers would be, you know, in the history books. They would be a thing of the past. And unfortunately, they still rage on and that industry is still growing. But,
Elaine, sorry, I don't know if you walked somewhere while we were talking just in the last moment. All of a sudden, your phone's kind of dropping in and out and kind of stuttering.
I'm sorry. I have a Yeah, my service isn't great here. I apologize.
It was better before. I just if you walk somewhere.
And in the exact same spot. Is it better now?
So far it's about the same, but I can always try to call you back if we need to start over here. But I just don't want anybody to miss anything that you're saying. So it sounds like you sort of didn't want it to be a calling in a way, but it became one.
Yeah, I never wanted to do a sanctuary until, you know, I rescued Stella, and that was the turning point. Can you hear me now, Duncan? Are you okay?
Yeah, it's a bit stuttery, though, unfortunately. It just became that way in the last minute and a half or so, unfortunately.
So
if it continues, I may just try to pause for a second, call you back, and see if we get a better connection.
Okay, or I can walk around, and you can tell me when it's good.
All right, well, meanwhile, while you're doing that, let me just let folks know again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Elaine West, founder of Rooterville Animal Sanctuary, located in Melrose, Florida, and housing rescued farm animals, pigs, cows, and many others. So we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Elaine, along the lines of it being a calling, or reluctantly becoming a calling, and observing your work guiding Rooterville all these years, it feels like you're propelled by some sort of spirituality, maybe even a religious essence. How would you respond to that assessment?
Well, I mean, it definitely is a passion, and I do love the animals, and I do love what I do, and I do love sharing them with people. I think what I do is not just a blessing to other people, but it's a blessing for me, too, to receive the joy that they bring to people. It really is special.
Yeah. So there is at least a spiritual element to kind of propelling you, it sounds
like.
Yeah,
and I think... you know, I am a Christian, and I believe that, you know, God, the very first vocation that he gave to us was gardener and keeper of the planet, and I think that we need to return to that because we've departed from that in such a horrific, really, way, and it's really a shame. Christian people, of all the people, should be the ones that want to, you know, protect God's earth and be a champion of God's creatures, not just humans, because it also affects the way that we're treating animals, and factory farming affects, you know, the poor and the marginalized, and it takes advantage of, you know, the labor force. You know, they can't get Americans to do the kind of dirty work in slaughterhouses that, you know, people from Mexico will do, immigrants. It's just really, there's so many aspects to animal agriculture that should cause Christians to be outraged and want to do something about it. And it's really sad that rather than embracing that it's kind of been poo-pooed, and like the crazy people are the ones that care about these kind of things. We all need to care because it affects us all, and it's destroying our planet and our health.
For sure. No, I understand what you're saying. And so let's circle back to something we sort of started to touch on, then we said we would come back and speak more directly about it. So after the foundation ended its support of Rooterville and other sanctuaries, I think you decided to relocate. That decision to relocate must have been huge, to say nothing of the task of relocating itself.
Oh, my God.
Can you talk a little bit about that, some of the biggest challenges of that?
Well, I would rather shoot myself than ever go through that again. It was such a nightmare moving. You know, we were left with, they were supposed to place all of the pigs and leave me with like 20, and I was going to retire. Well, they ended up leaving me with over 100, and then they promised they were going to support, you know, help me with some support, and then they didn't. And so I was left to fend for myself and try to figure out how I'm going to take care of, you know, over 100 animals, mostly pigs, all on my own. So you get really creative, and you think about what people want. And you know, the covered wagons came around, and when I saw those, I was like, that is a perfect fit, because I love for people to come and stay. We did a little bit of that at our other place. The other thing, Duncan, was I had to get on a paved road. I was on a dirt road. It was hard to find. People would get stuck getting there sometimes, and it was costing me a fortune to keep the road graded so that people could get down it.
And so I
had to find a place on a paved road. So
there were practical matters as well as financial ones that sort of drove this decision.
I had to get on a paved road. where people could find me easily in a good location where people from all over could come and, you know, RVs could get in here, tour buses could get in here, the average person can get in here and it's safe and it's easy, motorcycles can come. So and we're easy to find. So that was...
That probably made a huge difference, just those yes. few things. I think we have a caller here. Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Lane West.
Oh, I was just saying how you guys never pick up the phone, but you did. So it's what a switch. So I wanted to ask the woman a question.
Please, her name is Elaine. Go ahead.
Elaine, so, you know, I always wanted a pet pig, and I managed wild pigs in Hawaii. They helped me with my farm. But but I wanted to know, can you harvest the pigs when they're old and they die? Is there a place where you can actually eat them, like after they've lived a life and, you know, in a humanitarian kind of way, or if you have to euthanize them or something? Are they too old for harvesting as a food source?
Well, now stop and think about that for a minute. Do you harvest the animals that they can't find homes for at the shelters? You know, dogs and cats.
No, I mean, these animals are a pet. No, if they lived a whole full life and they're old and they die, can you still eat them?
I mean, you wouldn't eat your dog. I guess you think of them differently than what I think of them. These are my friends. I don't eat my friends.
That's a good point. I've never had one as a pet, but I've always wanted one as a pet. But I could actually talk to them, and they helped me manage they're like bulldozers. They actually manage.
Oh yeah, they're great for clearing land. Yeah,
they did.
We're not gonna
explore eating them after that. And I shot two pigs when I moved. I moved to Hawaii, shot two pigs, and then I stopped because I started talking to them. Like your show, Talking Animals, I actually could communicate. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, just like Dr. Doolittle, I could. So anyway, just for what it's worth.
Well, sounds like we've made some progress just in our short time together, so that's very good.
Thanks for picking up. You have a great show.
Well, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. All right, Elaine. So again.
People think that I should do something with the animals when I think that I euthanize them and actually bury them. It shocks people. It's like, well, you could give them to the homeless shelter and they could eat them. It's like, think about what you're saying.
Right. Well,
stop and think.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, I think what you did there just in that brief moment with the caller is, again, a lot of what you're doing at Rooterville with the kind of educational information that you have and the fact that people can interact with these animals. So, and just the connection is like the people often make over the years and sometimes more successfully than others, that these are not unlike your pet dog or your pet cat.
Yeah.
And if you look at it in the same way, then, you know, you probably wouldn't think about if
exactly.
and when you could have them for dinner. So
for dinner.
I think we might have another call. Let's see. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Elaine West.
Hi, yeah, I'm glad you said what you said about you wouldn't eat your other pets after they have died a long and actual life either. Kind of a weird call. I just want to thank you for what you have done. I'm a little discouraged. I've called Duncan's show before with other rescue folks on. It is my dream to have a sanctuary. But I'm a little discouraged based on what you said about the funding aspect. I'm not sure which foundation made those remarks to you, but, you know, that things are not as easy, it sounds like, with veterinary care and that sort of thing. So anything you can talk about that, and I just want to thank you for all the work. I'm on your website right now for that you've done for 30 years. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call.
Yeah. So here's the thing to that, those remarks. People think that they're going to start a sanctuary or a rescue and they're going to get a 501c and then people are just going to start pouring money to them. That is not the way it works. It took me at least a good 10 years to start getting donations that would help. It was not enough to cover everything. I was still using my own money. So it was a great deal of sacrifice to get started doing what I do. There's nothing easy about it unless you're really good at fundraising. You're really good at figuring out ways to make money because that's what you've got to do. You've got to have money to grow. You've got to have money to care for these animals the way they need to be cared for. And I have very high standards. My animals have breath. They can exhibit all of their natural behavior. They live the lives they want to live.
We're really, really stuttery again, Elaine. We're only in the last minute or two, but I don't know if you went anywhere, but we're told back to real stuttery. Can barely understand what you're saying. I'm sorry.
I have not moved, so it's just service.
Okay. All right, we'll just hang in there because we only have a minute or two left probably to chat.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I think that's probably better, yeah.
Okay, so I said it's really hard to get started. You have to fund it yourself. Imagine at least 5 years self-funding. And then after that, you'll start to get some momentum and start getting donations.
And what people often talk about amongst the many struggles is, or challenges, I should say, maybe, is that you're working around the clock, you're always fundraising or trying to plug a dike of some kind.
Stress.
And if you think you're going to get a vacation or whatever, you've got another thing coming in. It just, there's those things. But I mean, what's interesting, I think, about Rooterville, among many things, is that you faced some challenges, especially when that foundation ended the support of Rooterville and the other sanctuaries that had been helping. And then you just reinvented Rooterville and you found these agritourism measures to help pay the bills. And so you really just sort of hit the problem square on and solved it to the best of your ability. And now it's a different operation, but it's generating some funds that, like you say, you don't have to rely on donations so strictly. And that's an important story, I think.
Yeah, and I think if anyone wants to be a success in doing this kind of work, then that's what they need to do. Or they need to find, foundations that are going to support them. But you never know with donations when somebody's going to stop funding you, when it's going to end. So it's like you've got to be prepared to sink or swim.
Yeah. And again, sometimes economic factors or other things, people that typically have donated, maybe they used to give $100, maybe they give 50, and you start to add those things up. And again, it's tough for a place like Rooterville if you can't have a more constant revenue stream. So again, I think the covered wagons, which you alluded to, and I think I alluded to at the beginning of the show, is a place to stay. There's a farmhouse. You can park your RV there with the hookups and stuff. And, and again, how many people have had their wedding there? I found that fascinating that you could even have your wedding at Rooterville if you're so inclined.
So I've had one so far. It's something that I would like to see grow.
Sure.
A couple that I had, they just loved it. They couldn't say enough good things about their time here and their experience. So I know I've got a great thing. I just have to get the word out that we're here. And now I have some wedding pictures to share, what a wedding here is like. So hopefully that will continue to grow because that would really help us with funding.
Sure. And again, it doesn't have to be a wedding. As I understand it, you get old parties there or other events. So, and there's other kinds of ways, like you said before, just to visit and cuddle with some cows.
Doing great. Yeah, Jet, my Highland cow, has really kept the boat afloat here because without him, I don't know what I'd be doing. I've had him for two and a half years now, and thank God people love coming and cuddling with him. And now I've got some baby Highland cows, so we're expanding the cow cuddling because of the revenue that it brings. And the people just love it. I mean, people just love it. So,
and I would think that people wouldn't begrudge you implementing these things just because it's like, hey, this is paying for the food that these animals are eating and the vet bills that I'm still facing, and I'm just trying to look for ways to keep the place going.
Right. And the animals love it. I mean, I don't make an animal do anything that it doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
They're willing and happy participants.
And one thing I think I noticed that makes the sanctuary a little different than some is that the animals are kind of free to roam. So one animal, like a pig can hang out with a cow or a horse, little mini horse or whatever the case may be. And there's no separation by type of animal or, those kinds of...
Yeah, now the cows have their own pasture. But in the evening, I let the Highland cows out, and they're free roaming with everybody else. So everybody gets along, and it's wonderful. And the mini horses in the evening, if you stay, you get to experience it. You get to see the animals out and interacting with each other, and it's just really special here. I'm very proud of what I've created here and the way that my animals are treated and the lives that they live. I wish I could do more. That's the only thing, and it's hard to say no.
Sure.
Five or six times a week, I have to tell people, I'm sorry, but I can't take your animal.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you still get contacted all the time for that.
All the time.
But at least at this point, you know you have a clear no. It's not like you have to agonize over it the way you probably once did when people called up.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right, so we're just sort of nearing the time. One email I just wanted to read that came in and said, thank you, Duncan, for the show, and thanks to your guests for their loving heart and important work. So that might be just the right note to end this on. We've been speaking with Elaine West from Rooterville Animal Sanctuary. The website is rooterville.org. You can check out all the stuff we talked about, meet some of the animals, and figure out ways you might visit or have your wedding there or your party there or whatever. So, Elaine, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and thanks for all your great work over 30-some-odd years helping animals that had some tough situations, and you made their lives so much better.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. In a moment, I'll speak with Emily Capus, Chief Curator at the Jane Museum of Western Wildlife Art, about an exhibition on view there through September 14th entitled Rare Air, Endangered Birds, Bats, Butterflies, and Bees. We'll hear more about that exhibition, including its call to action, in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a nod to the cows at Rooterville. This is Kevin Nealon with a piece called Cows on the Roof in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
Most animals are smart, although, I remember during the tsunami in Sri Lanka, I read about this. The animals, they have like a sixth sense. They knew it was coming, and they took off for the hills the day before it happened. They all survived. They didn't tell anybody else. They kept it a secret. They, come on, just us. Come on, keep it quiet, move it along. Let's go. But I have a whole newfound respect for animals now. I give them a lot more credit. In fact, now when I see a dog chasing a car,
I got to run. I got to finish up the show, but I'll be back in touch, and I'll send you a note after the show.
I rescued a couple of cats not long ago.
Can send you a link and some stuff, but thank you so much.
Do your cats throw up all night long? Is that what they do?
All right, well, that's
is that
very
the
kind
M.O.?
Of you. Thank you, we'll talk to you
I mean,
soon.
All night long, all I heard was, and I wake up in the morning, and there is puke everywhere. It's like living in a fraternity house or something. You know, it's just crazy. And you know what? Not even puke. They're hairballs. And I know that because I sifted through it with a little stick. Couple of berries, but mostly hair. Yeah, and you got to get it off the carpet quick, otherwise it stains. You've got to make a decision: either get them off or let them accumulate and become like a sticky shag carpet after a while. Animals are smart, that's all I'm gonna say. I watch the Weather Channel. They always show the floods in the Midwest, right? And they show the cow up on the roof, surrounded by water. I don't know how she gets up there. I guess she comes up the stairs. I guess, do they have stairs in a barn? I don't know. She comes up the stairs, crawls out the window, grapples up to the roof, just waits it out. They should show that. Maybe they should have the Cow Network. I'd watch the Cow Network. But even here in California, the animals warn you before an earthquake. They'll start barking like crazy. The dogs, the cats will hide under the cars. You just have to know the signals, what to look for. Okay, like if you live in the Midwest, right, and you're going down the stairs and there's a cow coming up the other way, you get the boots. It's common sense.
That was Kevin Nealon in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Cows on the Roof, taken from his album, Kevin Nealon, Now Hear Me Out. Now it's time to speak with Emily Capus, Chief Curator at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art, about an exhibition on view there entitled Rare Air, Endangered Birds, Bats, Butterflies, and Bees. Let's hear more by welcoming Emily Capus to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, I missed that first part. I'm sorry. Thank you. Welcome to Talking Animals for sure. And let's, for those listening who may be unfamiliar, let's start by maybe just asking you to give a brief description of the James Museum itself.
Sure. We're located in downtown St. Petersburg, and we have an amazing collection of Western and wildlife paintings, sculptures, and jewelry. It's the collection of Tom and Mary James, and we've been open since 2018. So it's still fairly new, and we're getting the word out about this new exhibition called Rare Air.
Yeah, so the whole title, as I mentioned once or twice already, is Rare Air, Endangered Birds, Bats, Butterflies, and Bees. So beyond making good use of alliteration in its title, what else is notable about the exhibition from your standpoint?
Well, The artist Sarah Kazar is a Philadelphia-based designer, and these are original drawings that she's made in the past few years, where she's really dug in to consider how humans are connected to our creatures and how we interact with each other and how we affect each other. And these 72 creatures are all fragile and they're all endangered. And so she wants to bring to light their stories, their importance, and also just give some beauty to our community through the exhibition, because they're just gorgeous renderings and incredibly detailed.
And what forms do those pieces take? Are they various, working in various kinds of mediums? Or
She works in pen and ink, and she adds color with gouache. And they're just extraordinary. Some of the images that she has in her drawings that are very small, we've enlarged them into these graphics that cover the wall. And it's just extraordinary to see the detail, even that large.
Wow, that sounds very cool. And sounds like, at least implicit, there's a message that she's trying to communicate along with delivering these stunning pieces of work.
Absolutely. She first made a book of these species. And then she decided, hey, there's this wonderful art here. I really want more people to see it. And so she organized this traveling exhibition. So this has been all over the country. And when do you see art with bats? You know?
Yeah.
She made them actually kind of cute. So I think it's pretty amazing to get this close-up look at some of these creatures that we might not think about every day.
For sure. No, it sounds really cool, and it sounds like she's definitely trying to say, hey, let's take better care of some of these creatures so we don't lose them altogether.
Absolutely. There's some calls to action in the exhibition, like thinking about planting native plants and butterfly gardens and building a bat box. And there's lots of organizations that are mentioned to kind of help take the next step if you want to get involved.
That's really great. Well, this sounds good. So it's on view, as I think I mentioned, through September 14th. So we still have some time to catch the exhibit, Rare Air, Endangered Birds, Bats, Butterflies, and Bees, before it closes and moves probably elsewhere, I'm guessing.
Yes, I think it's headed to Delaware next. So we've got a few more weeks here. Even there's some activity tables in the exhibition with magnifying glasses, coloring book pages, the books. People can take close looks. So everybody, come on out to the James Museum.
That sounds great. Now, on a just slightly unrelated note, I have a question. I'd be interested in your perspective on the news that broke yesterday that Trump had ordered a review of exhibitions and materials across 8 Smithsonian museums. As a curator, how does that development hit you?
Goodness, I had not heard that news.
Oh.
I was not aware. I'll have to look more into that. It seems a bit troubling, but yeah, I'll have to take a look at that.
Okay, well, we'll get back to you on that, or you'll get back to us on that, because, yeah, I think for sure if you're a curator or otherwise, especially if it's the Smithsonian, but just generally, I think philosophically, that's troubling for people.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So basic details: the James open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. I think, and a bit longer hours on Tuesday till 8 p.m.
That's correct. That's our discount day, $10.
Great. So, and there's more information at thejamesmuseum.org for prices, tips for visiting, other info. So, Emily, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals, and that exhibition sounds fantastic.
Thank you. Hope to see everyone soon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Wall holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Patty Metz sitting in for Nancy C, hosting the Traffic Jam today from 3 to 6 p.m. Then it's Ali with Sound Safari, followed by the Step Outside Guys. And just so much great stuff continuing after that here on 88.5 WNF. Meanwhile, on this show, at the moment, it's a prize for Name That Animal Tune. We're offering something fabulous from the Talking Animals Vault, some sort of trinket or gift or a nice memento that you'll love, I'm sure. The first person who calls 813 239-9663 correctly identifies this animal song. It's named that animal tune. I'm talking animals on WMNF. About reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. You can always take a name that I'm a tune guest after the show. So still have that prize in store for you if you do call just afterwards. But we are wrapping up today's edition of Talking Animals, as I say. Next Wednesday, August 20th, my guest will be award-winning filmmaker Joshua Zeman. In his new documentary, Checkpoint Zoo, Zeman and his film crew chronicle an unusual rescue mission on the front lines of the war in Ukraine. People risking their lives to save 5,000 animals stuck in a zoo located in the direct line of Russian bombing. So, invited to join us for that conversation next week with Joshua Zeman about Checkpoint Zoo. Also invited to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts are available there, as well as other podcast platforms. Also links to our social media pages and more. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand. And other news from the Talking Animals world. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Wichita, and beyond. NPR News headlines coming shortly. And then stay tuned for the conversation and everything beyond. I'll catch you next Wednesday here on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Thanks.